Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only, and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information and situations. The name of the show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. The show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pens so you can take notes during the show. Today, I'd like to deal with a special topic. What does your credit card company know about you? This is from the New York Times business expert Charles Duhigg. Rudy Santana's day began recently, as almost all his working days begin, with the name on a screen. The name that April morning belonged to a Massachusetts man in his mid-30s. He owed money on a credit card and a second mortgage, the screen told Santana, and was separated from his wife. He was behind in paying back $28,900.97 in debt, which was why he was on Santana's screen. When Santana reached him by the phone, the man quickly began talking about his wife. "Listen," the man said, "I called her back about this debt, and a guy picked up, a guy I've never heard before, and when I asked for her, he hung up on me. Can you believe that? We used that money to renovate the kitchen, and now she won't even talk to me. Who the hell was that guy who answered the phone?" "So you've spoken to your wife?" Santana asked, his voice soft and gentle. "Were you able to have a good talk with her? Even when you're angry, it's important to talk. Did you talk about the debt?" "Yeah, we talked about it," the man replied. He paused and released a small sob. "You know, she told me we would be together until we died. I know I have to pay this, but I'm not going to pay her half. I won't pay it." "I know," Santana said. "This is difficult, and I'll be honest. I think you're doing a great job. You're really strong. But the thing is, to the bank, they don't make a distinction between you and your wife. To them, it's just debt. They just want to get paid." "I think I can do something for you, though," Santana continued, glancing at his screen. It was filled with information about the man, including the fact that he had recently sold his home at a loss. Some of this information had been sent by the man's bank to Santana's employer, Sunrise Credit Services, which collects delinquent debts for companies like Citigroup, Bank of America, and HSBC. Santana's company had added notes, too, including helpful tips. He is easier to reach in the mornings, for example, and new ways to contact him. "Look," Santana said, "I know you're angry at your wife. One step to ending that anger is putting this debt behind you. It will really help you find peace. You owe about $29,000. How much do you think you can pay?" "Well, how much are you going to help me?" the man shot back. "These banks got all this taxpayer money from the government, and they're the ones who ruined the market for my house. I helped bail them out. I think the banks should be paying me instead of trying to suck all the life out of us they can." It was the first of numerous blow-ups that Santana would confront that day. Bill collectors don't tend to encounter many pleasantries, even in the best of times, and these are nowhere near the best of times for borrowers or for the banking and credit card industries that lend to them. After 2 decades of almost constant expansion and profitability, credit card companies today are in deep trouble. Monstrous losses, estimated to top $395 billion over the next 5 years, are growing as cardholders, brought low by the recession, walk away from their debts. And Congress and the President are pushing for legislation that would make it much harder for companies to hike up interest rates and charge many of the sneaky fees that have been an easy source of revenue for years. So credit card firms are changing their business plans. Gone are the days of handing out cards willy-nilly and hoping that the cardholders who dutifully pay up will offset the losses from those who default. Today, companies are focusing on those customers most likely to honor their debts. And they are looking for ways to convince existing cardholders that if they only have enough money to pay one bill, it's wiser to pay off their credit card than, say, the phone. Put another way, credit card companies are becoming much more interested in understanding their customers' lives and psyches because, the theory goes, knowing what makes cardholders tick will help firms determine who is a good bet and who should be shown the door as quickly as possible. Luckily for the industry, small groups of executives at most of the large firms have spent the last decade studying cardholders from almost every angle, and collection agencies have developed more sophisticated dunning techniques. They have sought to draw psychological and behavioral lessons from enormous amounts of data that credit card companies collect every day. They've run thousands of tests and crunched the numbers on millions of accounts. One result of all that labor is the conversation between Santana, a former bouncer whose higher education consists solely of corporate-sponsored classes like The Psychology of Collections, and the man from Massachusetts. When Santana contacted the man last month, he was armed with detailed information about his life and trained in which psychological approaches were most likely to succeed. Eventually, the man from Massachusetts called Santana back with a proposal. He had spoken to his ex-wife, he said. They wanted to wipe out their debt by paying just $10,000, only 35% of what they owed. Santana had actually already sought permission from the bank to settle for as little as $10,000. It's an open secret that if a debtor is willing to wait long enough, he can probably get away with paying almost nothing as long as he doesn't mind hurting his credit score. So Santana knew he should jump at the offer. But as an amateur psychologist, Santana was eager to make his own diagnosis and presumably boost his own commission. I don't think that's going to work, Santana told the man. Santana's classes had focused on Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, a still popular mid-century theory of human motivation. Santana had initially put this guy on the love-belonging level of Maslow's hierarchy and built his pitch around his relationship with his ex-wife. But Santana was beginning to suspect that the debtor was actually in the esteem phase, where respect is a primary driver. So he switched tactics. You spent this money, Santana said. You made a promise. Now you have to decide what kind of a world you want to live in. Do you want to live around people who break their promises? How are you going to tell your friends or your kids that you can't honor your word? The man mulled it over, and a few days later he called back and said he'd pay $12,000. Boom, baby, Santana shouted as he put down the phone. It's all about getting inside their heads and understanding what they need to hear. It really feels great to know I'm helping people in pain. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Today, I'm taking a little bit of a detour from the course I've been teaching and talking about credit card company psychological techniques for getting your money. I'm pulling from an article called What Does Your Credit Card Company Know About You? From the New York Times by Charles Duhigg. To understand how the credit card industry got interested in psychology, you really have to go way back to a time when many Americans didn't have a credit card, when almost every company charged the same interest rate regardless of a cardholder's riskiness, and when people often paid off their entire balance each month. That's all the way back, which is about the 1980s. Just a little more than two decades ago, the credit card business was a quiet, slightly boring industry, really dominated by banks looking for easy revenue. Card issuers made money by collecting annual fees, interest payments from cardholders, as well as fees from merchants each time a customer used a card. What happened, though, is that the math whizzes arrived. They emphasized that the biggest profits didn't come from people who always paid off their bills, but rather from less responsible people who never paid their entire balance and thus could be milked through silently skyrocketing interest rates, late fees, and other penalties. So since 1995, the percentage of the industry's income from cardholder fees has more than doubled to 40%. In 2005, as the push to sign up cardholders peaked, the industry sent out more than 10.2 billion credit card solicitations, which would cover more than the entire world's population, obviously. And according to RK Hammer, a credit card advisory firm, 2 years later, credit card companies collected $40.7 billion in profits before taxes. It's interesting to note that today Americans carry an average of 5.3 all-purpose cards in their wallets, and the average household has $10,679 in credit card debt, according to the industry publication, the Nielsen Report. But giving credit cards to riskier customers posed a problem. How do you know which cardholders will pay something each month, providing fat profits, and which will simply run up a huge tab and then disappear or file bankruptcy? The PhDs arrived at two solutions. The first was to create thousands of new kinds of cards with their own credit limits, terms, and interest rates. Such a strategy theoretically protected companies by limiting how much a cardholder could buy and by charging sufficiently high interest rates to ensure that if a few cardholders walked away, the company still made plenty of money. The other solution or angle was learning to predict how different types of customers would behave. Card companies began running tens of thousands of experiments, believe it or not, each year, testing the emotions elicited by various card colors and the appeal of different envelope sizes, for instance, or whether new immigrants were more responsible than cardholders born in this country. By understanding customers' psyches, the companies hoped they could tell who was a bad risk and either deny the application or, for those who were already cardholders, start shrinking their available credit and increasing minimum payments to squeeze out as much cash as possible before the people defaulted. So the exploration into cardholders' minds was there, and it hit a breakthrough in 2002 when J.P. Martin, a math-loving executive at Canadian Tire, decided to analyze almost every piece of information his company had collected from credit card transactions from the previous year. Canadian Tire stores sold electronics, sporting equipment, kitchen supplies, and automotive goods, and issued a credit card that could be used almost anywhere. Martin could often see precisely what cardholders were purchasing, and he discovered that the brands we buy are the windows into our souls, or at least into our willingness to make good on our debts. So his data indicated, for instance, that people who bought cheap, generic automotive oil were much more likely to miss a credit card payment than someone who got the expensive name brand stuff. People who bought carbon monoxide monitors for their homes or those little felt pads that stopped chair legs from scratching the floor almost never missed payments. Whereas anyone who purchased a chrome skull car accessory or a mega thruster exhaust system was pretty likely to miss paying his bill eventually. It turns out that Martin's measurements were so precise that he could tell you the riskiest drinking establishment in Canada, Shark's Pool Bar in Montreal, where 47% of the patrons who used their Canadian Tire card missed four payments over the next 12 months. And he could also tell you the safest products, premium bird seed and a device called a snow roof rake that homeowners use to remove high up snow drifts so they don't fall on pedestrians. Remember, this is in Canada. Now, testing indicated that Martin's predictions, when paired with other commonly used data like cardholders' credit histories and incomes, were often much more precise than what the industry traditionally used to forecast cardholder riskiness. By the time he publicized his findings, a small industry of math fanatics, many of them former credit card executives, had started consulting for the major banks that issued cards, and they began using Martin's findings and other research to build psychological profiles. Now let's think, why did birdseed and snow rake buyers pay off their debts? Well, the answer, research indicated, was that the customers felt a sense of responsibility toward the world, which manifested in their spending on birds they didn't own and pedestrians they didn't know. Why were felt pad buyers so upstanding? Because they wanted to protect their belongings, be they hardwood floors or credit scores. And why did chrome skull owners skip out on their debt? The person who buys a skull for their car, they are like people who go to a bar named Sharks. Would you give them a loan? Now, some credit card companies began using these and other discoveries to find new customers and to scrutinize existing cardholders. A few firms began sending offers to people who had registered for baby showers or weddings, for example, since data showed that getting married or having a child, in addition to making people buy lots of new stuff, often also makes them more responsible. Other companies started cutting cardholders' credit lines when charges appeared for pawn shops or marriage therapy because data indicated those were signs of desperation or depression that might lead to job loss and, of course, financial loss. But on the whole, companies, including Canadian Tire, stuck to more traditional methods of managing risk, like 1. Raising interest rates when someone was paying a bill late because they worried that customers would revolt if they found out they were being studied so closely. So according to Martin, who, by the way, now works for Walmart Canada, he said that if you show us what you buy, we can tell you who you are, maybe even better than you know yourself. But everyone was scared that people will resent companies for knowing too much. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And today I'm talking about the psychology that credit card companies and lenders use in giving out their loans. So continuing, what happened was, though, that last year the economy blew up and 3 things became obvious very quickly. First, all those extra charges that theoretically protected credit card companies from losing money. Well, the worst case models were way off and some companies started hemorrhaging cash. Second, many of the predictions that the credit card companies built around their understandings of people's psyches were surprisingly accurate even during an economic tsunami. And finally, when people start losing their jobs and feeling poor, it suddenly becomes very, very important to figure out how to persuade them to pay their credit card bills. So we see that data-driven psychologists are now in high demand, and the industry is using them not only to screen out risky debtors, but also to determine which cardholders need a phone call to persuade them to mail in a check. Most of the major credit card companies have set up systems to comb through the cardholder's data for signs that someone is going to stop making payments. For example, are cardholders suddenly logging in at 1 in the morning? It might signal sleepiness due to anxiety. Are they using their cards for groceries? It might mean that they are trying to conserve cash. Have they started using their cards for therapy sessions? Do they call the card company in the middle of the day when they should be at work? What do they say when a customer service representative asks how they are feeling? Are their size long or short? Do they respond better to a comforting or bullying tone? These are the kind of issues that the data collectors in the card companies are investigating. It's really hard to get clean insights of a cardholder's state of mind, according to Andy Jennings, the head of research and development at FICO, one of the biggest and oldest analytic firms. He said the more subtle the insight, the more cleverness finding it requires. If someone pays for a big cable television package each month with their card, are they rich? Or does it signal they don't have the sense to avoid products they can't afford? If they check their balance 3 times a day, are they worried or uptight? At FICO, they look at 300 different characteristics just to predict their delinquency risk, the delinquency risk of the consumer, that is. What happens is, if a credit card company detects unsettling patterns, it might start cutting credit lines, raising interest rates, or accelerating repayment schedules. In fact, companies are expected to withdraw $2.7 trillion of credit by the end of 2010, according to a report from the Meredith Whitney Advisory Group, a banking analyst firm. But the most useful information the card companies are deriving from their data are the insights that help them deepen their relationship with customers, particularly when a cardholder is going through a rough time. One of the strongest conclusions of the psychological studies is that the cardholders are most likely to pay the bills of those companies with which they have an emotional connection. And this is why they're making those calls. According to Carl Pascarella, a former chief executive of Visa USA, he said that the goal today is for customers to get a warm and fuzzy feeling from the credit card company and to have a deep relationship with the company over a range of products and experience. He said that if we trust each other, you'll listen when we give you advice, which means that people can be manipulated by the credit card company. It turns out that companies now have credit card customer assistance employees who go through some interesting courses. And here's an example. The first day of training for Bank of America's newest credit card customer assistance employees, some of the 12 new hires sitting around the classroom were really a little confused. At other companies, these employees who earn about $35,000 a year might be called collection agents or at-risk account reps. But at Bank of America, the program is built around assisting the customer, explained Rick Struthers, president of the credit card division. He said, "We call it assistance because we're here to find a solution." In the report, the writer said that he was allowed to see how one company transforms thousands of low-paid employees into telephone psychiatrists, going to the Bank of America's 4-week training program at the company's offices in Delaware. So at the front of the classroom, a poster explained the company's, quote, customer delight model, end quote. The trainees were supposed to provide a delightful opening, employ delightful words, acknowledge and empathize, and personalize with a power close. So I'll say that again. They were to provide a delightful opening, employ delightful words, acknowledge and empathize, and personalize with a powerful close. They spent the mornings discussing hypothetical cases, like a cardholder with twins whose husband announced he had fallen in love with another woman. He handed over divorce papers, had a moving truck outside, and in short order took over the house and left the cardholder with 2 kids, only $400 a week, and a ton of credit card debt. Obviously a hypothetical example. So during the course, one of the trainees said, "I would tell her to castrate the man." And another said, you know, Mel Gibson is getting a divorce, and what he's doing to that poor woman, he should get his gut hacked up with a rusty knife. I would tell her to cut the husband where it matters and then ask the new girlfriend what she thinks of what's down there now. Well, these were not apparently the delightful words that Bank of America had in mind. Another trainee opined that there might be more delicate ways of handling the conversation. In response to that, the other employee said, what do you know? You've never been married. You spent your whole life on vacation. Why don't you learn something instead of moving your mouth all the time? Now, this is a training session that's going on. And in fact, that was the power close that was suggested. So the class continued to discuss how to talk to someone who has recently lost her husband or her job. And then one of the students' trainees asked, when we hear a story like this, how are we going to ask them for money? And the instructor said that we'll get to that later. And then the trainees listened to a recording of an actual call with a cardholder who was about $10,000 in debt, divorced, and couldn't pay her bills. The Bank of America representative was chipper and positive, and after 10 minutes offered to cut the woman's minimum monthly payments in half and drop her interest rate to 5%. The response was, oh my God, the cardholder sobbed onto the tape. Oh, that would help so much. I'm not a bad person. No, of course you aren't, the representative from the credit card company replied. We're going to figure this out together. And you may have had these kinds of conversations because such conversations, credit card companies say, happen all the time. I will continue this investigation into credit card company psychology next week. And today I'd like to end with a poem called Slow Dance. Have you ever watched kids on a merry-go-round or listened to the rain slapping on the ground? Ever followed a butterfly's erratic flight or gaze at the sun in the fading night? You better slow down. Don't dance so fast. Time is short. The music won't last. Do you run through each day on the fly? When you ask, how are you, do you hear the reply? When the day is done, do you lie in your bed with the next 100 chores running through your head? You better slow down. Don't dance so fast. Time is short. The music won't last. Ever told your child we'll do it tomorrow and in your haste not see her sorrow? Ever lost touch? Let a good friendship die, 'cause you never had time to call and say hi. You'd better slow down. Don't dance so fast. Time is short. The music won't last. When you run so fast to get somewhere, you miss half the fun of getting there. When you worry and hurry through your day, it is like an unopened gift thrown away. Life is not a race. Do take it slower. Hear the music before the song is over. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life. You are listening to the open source sounds of Wicked All Stars. The song is Jazz House from the album Dark Clouds, available from Magnatune.